and he held the spirits of his valley, repelling the light with every fiber of his being. Harmag. Harmag. He plunged his consciousness into the chasm, resolute to reach the bottom of the pit, that mysterious domain where darkness and light are one, all powers are comprehended, and all things are possible. Tightening every muscle of his huge body and squeezing his kidneys for strength, he furiously invoked, Harmag. Harmag. From the depths of the abyss, a hungry hissing breath of infinite darkness responded, enveloping him, inviting him into the pit. So great was the pull, so irresistible the charm, that Bob Rose threw himself into the arms of his beloved evil knight. He jumped into the abysmal crevasse. He sacrificed himself, releasing into the valley the fruits of his lifelong chromantic passion for the dark side. The mists were thickened with his venom, the spirits of nature were fed with his wrath. The furtive glimpse of light vanished. Doom and gloom were back. The valley of the necromancer lived. Meanwhile, the formidable power of the thunderbolt bearers went on consuming the evil sludge, the tension rising so high that in less than 3 minutes, all the darkness that Bob Rose had spread was neutralized. Nadavan was completely cleared, the plague of Israim destroyed, and all traces of Bob Rose's evil influence had disappeared from the county. When Orest saw that the power of the hymns was about to attack the darkness of the valley of the necromancer, he raised his hand and stopped the ritual, for he was wise and knew that all things have their place in the world. The valley was the keeper of ancient forces, and deserved respect for the uniqueness of its energy. Victory was total, in any case. There was nothing left of the foul fibrous shins with which Bob Rose had thought he could poison Isrim and its boring counties. The thunderbolt bearers became silent. In the heavens the celestial beings applauded and sung astonishing hymns, ready to receive Orest like a hero among gods and men. In the eastern peninsula, the giants, enraged at seeing one of their champions defeated, roared their fury and swore revenge. Nowhere, Ahriman shrugged his shoulders, unconcerned, and resumed his tasks of endless darkness. We won, Lucina. A triumph. Muridji the prophetess hurrahed. Lucina, unsure of what exactly had been won, but taken by an irresistible feeling of victory, stood up and clapped her hands, and all the priestesses in the chapel followed her. They laughed loudly, and congratulated each other. Thanks to Muridji, the word soon reached all the other chapels of the Temple of Israim, and everyone acclaimed Orest of the Brown Robe for what was to be remembered as the clearing of Aripa. 1.5 The creation myth of the Thunderbolt Bearer's sunset had finally arrived. The incandescent obelisk had regained its original size, but the entire plain of Aripa was still inundated with white light. The 100 Thunderbolt Bearers stood silent and motionless like pillars of light, their auras ablaze with the unfathomable energy unleashed by the word of thunder. Gervin, Bark and Seer by his side, stood at the entrance of the corridor of light, with the fire and the obelisk at the other end, and Orest meditating behind the fire. Now, Bark and Seer gave the signal, touching Gervin's shoulder. Gervin turned his head towards him briefly, saying farewell with his eyes. Truly, he was bidding farewell to himself. He knew that as soon as he entered the corridor, he would never be the same again. 3 steps separated Gervin from the corridor of light and the mysteries of the Thunderbolt Bearers. He took the first step, whispering the verse of the law, one way. He who never sleeps, never dies. Then the second step. From the Tower of Mulchasek, Marka heard the farewell. She surrendered to the high light of her angel and whispered back, farewell, beautiful man. Far away in the north, close to the great lake of the county of Parenti, an old, wrinkled woman remembered the son who had left her long ago, and she cried. She called her husband, Arvin of the Law. Gervin is dying. Our son is dying, we'll never see him again. Old Arvin bit his lip, a habit he had caught from his father and cultivated through a long life of disappointments, and he prayed the good Lord Melchizedek had mercy on his son. He had been such a good boy, and smart, when he was little. Why the underworld did he want to travel and follow that damn brown monk? Arvin puzzled once more. Such a waste. He could have been so happy as a ferryman, with me and his uncle. And he sighed, his eyes fixed on the smoky fire at the center of the one-room shack of mud bricks, pondering on the wonderful opportunities missed, and the good life Gervin could have had if only he had listened to the wisdom of his father. In a chapel of the female wing of the Temple of Israim, Muridji of the Pasoft-Pul robe was shocked out of her meditation by one of the brightest visions she had ever received. "Lucina," she whispered in her prophetic voice, her eyes half closed, astonished by what she was seeing. "Go and tell them."
"What, Muridji? They're going to throw Gervin into the fire."
"Who?" Lucina froze in terror. "The Nephilim giants?"
"No, Orest and his friends."
"Oh, my God. If Gervin survives that, then,
oh, my God."
Muridji was interrupted by another vision, coming from the world of the gods. "And tell them that the gods," she started saying, but a sea-soft-lestial providence shut her up. Far above, in the sky of the gods, the sons of Apollo stopped their flight and directed their blazing gaze to the plain of Erebor. Much, much further away, beyond the fields of stars and the mysterious vault of eternity, spread in an infinity of superimposed spaces and lateral realities, a flying dragon heard Gervin's farewell. "Welcome to eternity, friend of the Hu-Soft-Man hierarchy," went the whisper. And the Mother of the Light smiled. Gervin took the third step. As he entered the corridor, all light disappeared, and the obelisk of fire, and the 100 thunderbolt bearers. He saw but darkness, surrounded by darkness, as it was before the beginning, when the creation had not yet begun, and time had not yet started its course. There was neither left nor right, neither top nor bottom, neither death nor immortality. In an uncontained voidness, a fluid breath of nothingness swept a naught-dimensional space, a wombness of times to come, where all possible futures were contained as seeds. In this noble chaos, which was both nowhere and everywhere, a symphony of voices rose, which revealed life out of darkness, and prepared for the birth of the light. The voices were chanting the dawn of creation. It was the first breath, the first wind. And there was a center, and a periphery, and limits were born, so that infinity could breathe. And up looked down, and down smiled back. The one had become two, ready to desire each other, but not yet fully aware of how far they would have to go, and how long it would take before they could become one again. By then, time was already born. A cosmos of immense complexity had begun, myriads of expanding spaces, worlds running in all directions, spheres revolving around spheres, and creatures born in all the worlds. The Azuras came first, and they were formidable. Standing on top of the creation, their primordial powers unchallenged, they shouted loud, amazed at their own glory, intoxicated with their own might. And they became proud and arrogant. They proclaimed themselves the one God, forgetting that their shining lights were but reflections of the one glorious source to whom they owed their birth. Thus the Azura of life became the Azura of death. The Azura of might became the Lord of war. Great angelic lighthouses turned into principles of darkness, and after them, the blazing light-bearer fell into Lucifer. And the Ancient of Ancients cursed them, and shattered their worlds, and caused a second creation of gods. Born from the Mother of the Light, the gods woke up in the molten sea, and they sacrificed to the one God, and the strength of the one God was their strength. And there were wars in the heavens, awesome clashes in which the spheres were set ablaze, and entire planets shattered into asteroidic pebbles. Light fought against darkness, gods against Azuras, angels against titans, spirits of truth against fallen angels. The gods triumphed at the summit of the spheres. They conquered the nectar of immortality, and its archetypal powers, mastered the mathematical magic of the uppermost sky, and with genius and boldness, repelled their enemies into lower regions. A safe heaven they made for themselves, a glorious world of light and fire, the top of a high pyramid of worlds, towering upon innumerable other spheres of lesser fire, lesser clarity, lesser joy, lesser fun, and marred with mirages, illusion, boredom. Such was the victory of the gods, and it was great and absolute, but only at the top of the pyramid of the worlds. Elsewhere, an uncertain and precarious balance remained,
a cosmos of compromise and half-truths which were but flagrant lies, and where light and darkness kept fighting wars, but only by proxy, and often in disguise, and none ever gaining the decisive edge, dilly-dallying seemingly endlessly, delaying the deadly apocalyptic toll of a final, total confrontation. In this established order of clear blurriness, human beings were still fast asleep, having not yet noticed the cosmic night had ended. They lay blissfully in the bosom of the gods and basked in the gods' glorious light, which they could not distinguish from the primordial darkness. Spread in a bottomless chasm of forever oneness, they slept. They slept a dreamless sleep, a beatific embrace with God, a soporized ecstasy of transcendental magnitude. To help them awaken, the gods fashioned a world for them. A young, fresh, juicy maiden earth, an all-fluid virgin, teeming with unbridled life force, and youthful folly, and strange gigantic beasts, and volcanic wonders. These were the ancient days of the earth, the early land of Mu, when every atom was vibrant with magic, and the breath of the one god breathed through every wind, and the wet air's warmth was infused with cosmic fire, and the pregnant ocean remembered the secrets of the primordial night. Few, very few, were those who awoke in the first hour. They became the great magicians of the ancient days, they commanded over the awesome forces of the young world. Nature was their enslaved lover, never refusing them a thing, and they penetrated all her mysteries, and they stamped her bosom with their spells. But these magician conquerors of nature were but scarce exceptions in a world where all other human beings were still fast asleep, drifting blobs, monotonously fulfilled and hopelessly peaceful, with no desires, and good food in plenty, their needs satisfied before they could even feel them. Painlessly they dropped blobets behind them to populate the new world. And it lasted a long, long time, but they did not wake up. When the gods sent the call and resounded the trumpets of destiny, the magician conquerors heard, and they understood, and guided by the gods, they left. But the blobs heard nothing, for they were fast asleep. And the earth was shaken, continents rose and others disappeared. The stupefied Adam Eve blob became Adam and Eve, naked, already desiring each other. But why did it have to hurt so much? And how far would they have to go? And how long would it take before they could find each other again? The moon, which by then had just arrived, completely unnoticed, knew the secret, and kept it for a distant future. Seeing this rapidly deteriorating world, in which the winds of God would soon run out of breath, and sleep had become the antidote to the agonizing pain of being separated from him, from her, from the light and from God, the Lord Melchizedek had mercy. With his great angels, he manifested a law, and the law was revealed to Manu, and Manu revealed it to men. The kingdom of Atlantis was born, safely enclosed in womb-like mists. Set into motion by the law, the blobs became cobblers, builders, fishermen, fathers and mothers, priests and priestesses. Everyone had a place, a name, a caste, a role, and a destiny. A language, alive with many powers of the gods, was given to them, for them to chant the magic hymns of the law and sacrifice to the gods, and thus bring kind weather onto themselves, and rains in plenty, gorgeous orchards, abundant crops, and healthy offspring. Through the power of the hymns, the gods were with them, and the spirit of the one god breathed in their blood, that they might slowly awaken, and stop being sleepers. Tens of thousands of years passed. A glorious civilization grew, a large, majestic tree, rooted in the revelation of the law, arts, and laws, and a masterful know-how of all things of nature, phenomenal mastery of etheric forces and plants' growth, and fields of energy which accomplished all manner of miraculous feats, and oracles and temples in plenty to celebrate the mysteries. And tens of thousands of years passed. But when the Lord Melchizedek looked down to the kingdom, he saw that the children of his law had not yet awakened. Now they were sleeping with their eyes open, having turned his wonderful revelation into lengthy codes of rules which they repeated like parrots, while fixed in habits and customs they comfortably slumbered, a perfection rendered smothering and sterile by so much zeal and faith. The bold knowledge which he had given them to break new ground, to step out of the blob stage, and to awaken to the infinity of creation, They had made a prison, with his high priests the jailers. The Lord Melchizedek saw the cosmic tragedy and judged that the time was coming. The prison would have to be shattered, so a new kingdom could be born. And moved by compassion for the children of his law, he prepared the chaos, and the plagues, and the deluge that was to destroy the kingdom of Atlantis. Gervin had arrived in front of the fire and the obelisk of light. In one glimpse he realized the unavoidable fate which awaited the kingdom. He saw cities in flames, ransacked temples, large-scale pillage, famines, and epidemics. More frightening even was the collective insanity which accompanied this tragedy, and which only the final flood would wash away from the surface of the earth. There followed barbaric times, a world of darkness and desolation, emptied of the presence of the gods, and in which the law and all the knowledge of the temples were lost. On the other side of the fire, Orest now stood up, and raised his arms. Responding to his signal, Barkhansir and the 100 thunderbolt bearers once more projected the word of thunder. The obelisk of light exploded, and the plain of Ereba was flooded with white light. Through the fire, Gervin saw the eyes of Orest. From the uppermost reaches of the sky of the gods, a shaft of lightning struck. The flash brought a revelation to Gervin's consciousness, the master plan of the brown robe. In the fields of peace, the Temple of Light stood ready to re-soft hyphens the entire knowledge of Israim and Lassia in the form of a phenome soft hyphen al archive. All glory to the teacher. He projected with the word of thunder, and walked into the fire. Orest, looking straight into his eyes, joined him in the fire, and a massive transfer of forces was sparked. Gervin screamed, and from the uppermost sky, the ultimate summit of the worlds of the gods, he saw the primordial night, and the chant of the dawn of creation, the superb Azuras, the birth of the gods, the wars in heaven, the magicians of the ancient days, the moon leaving the earth and the blowbets torn asunder, and the Lord Melchizedek, and his law, and the deluge at the end of the kingdom, and the kingdom of the rainbows after it, and the kingdoms which followed, the true and the false messiahs, the war of all against all. The knights of the apocalypse fighting in space, the triumph of the light, and those left behind, and the masoft hyphen tority of the human hierarchy, when Eve finally found Adam. The moon had known all along, the spreading in multidimensional enlightenment, and the end of time, and the cosmic night, all in 1 second, all in 1 point. And he saw the web of love which the Lord Melchizedek had woven in his spheres, and it shone far in remoteness. From beyond the abyss of the deep, the flying dragon smiled at Gervin and repeated his welcome message, using universal language. Muridji saw, and she remained silent. 1.6 The archive and the temple in the fields of peace. It was late at night. Melchid, Melchid the Pure, as Orest chose to call him, was sitting on a log at the edge of the plain of Ereba, wondering what would happen to him now that his master had left the kingdom. At the age of 19, he was the youngest of the brown robe, having been initiated by Orest only 9 months earlier. At the time he had thought the initiation ceremony the most incredible of all the rituals performed in the kingdom. Now, he looked back and smiled. Ran Grisset, his elder by 15 years, came to sit by his side. He put his hand on his shoulder, feeling a bit low? Perhaps. After such a high, it's more than normal. Did Barkhansir speak to you? Ran Grisset asked. Melchid shook his head. Srevin was walking towards them, carrying a bundle of dry branches. Barkhansir is coming, he announced. Let's light a fire. Now the thunder soft hyphen bolt bearers have left, it feels much colder down here. Melchid and Ran Grisset gathered a few more branches, and the fire was soon lit. Praise the great Apollo, Master Barkhansir. Melchid exclaimed with a touch of wonder when he saw the great sage approaching. Barkhansir's leg soft hyphen end made even the most accomplished of the masters of thunder raise their eyebrows in amazement. As foretold in many prophecies, each time he appeared to the kingdom he deeply influenced the fate of the brown robe. Here are the masters of thunder. Praise the great Apollo, my brothers. Barkhansir saluted the three men in his warm voice. Let us sit together, if not in the fire as your brethren do when they meet in high spheres, at least around this beautiful fire. He turned to Melchard. How is the Mother of the Light treating you, young man?
Well, Master Barkenseer, Melchard smiled. Being addressed by Barkenseer was like receiving a high wind of spirit that illuminated your energy and filled you with enthusiasm.
You must not blame destiny for taking Orest away from the kingdom, Barkenseer's voice carried the balm of the waters. If we have chosen Gervin to be the Thunderbolt Bearer at the time of the archive transfer, it is because he is an extraordinarily gifted man, who will be remembered as one of the greatest masters of our lineage. You are privileged, really, to have the opportunity of learning from him and serving Thunder under his guidance, especially during these critical times when so much will depend on you.
Praise the great Apollo. S. Revan voiced his enthusiasm. When shall we begin the great task?
Barkenseer replied with one of the sayings of Thunder, right now. And the three men laughed and rejoiced.
S. Revan will direct the operations in the Temple of Lassira, Barkenseer went on. The Archive will gather the spiritual forces and the knowledge from both temples, Lassira and Israim.
Gervin and Melchard will hold Israim while S. Revan holds Lassira.
What about Rangrosset? Melchard asked.
My mission is to go north, brother, Rangrosset said with great softness, for he knew that Melchard would not like the news.
North? Where? Melchard asked anxiously.
Rangrosset took a long breath.
Far. Beyond the seas of the northern shores of the kingdom, in a desert land where there is nothing but ice.
Melchard had tears in his eyes. Does this mean you are not coming back?
I'm afraid so, brother. Rangrosset is needed in the lands of the far north, at the extreme limit of the world, Barkenseer explained. From there, he will conduct a long ritual. Indispensable for the archive transfer. Melchard's sadness was deep. During the difficult years of his apprenticeship in the brown robe, Rangrosset had not only been a marvelous teacher but also a real brother to him. Having to lose him, just after losing Orest, was a devastating blow.
Friends, you shall meet again, and sooner than you think, Barkenseer said. His voice comforting like the Sunday in a matter of months, Gervin will e-soft-th you into the art of being parallel. Living in two worlds at the same time.
S. Revan slapped Melchard's shoul soft-de, bringing a glow of wonder in the young man's eyes.
Exactly. This art is central to the higher echelons of the initiation in the brown robe.
Gervin himself became a parallel at the very moment of his installation as a new Thunderbolt Bearer. He now lives in the fields of peace as well as in the kingdom. This sounded so extraordinary that for one moment Melchard forgot his sad soft-ness. The fields of peace were the pure world, the world to come, the perfect soft-shin which the physical world aspired to achieve, but which already existed be soft-yond the physical world. The fields of peace are the future of humanity, Orest often taught his disciples. The immaculate dwelling human beings will inhabit when all is accomplished.
Soon, you will join Gervin in the fields of peace, Barkenseer was warm.
There you will find a team of extremely powerful masters of thunder waiting for you, Alambarseer and Farenseer, who are two of my disciples, Matt Zionsoft-Dranarth, Olembana, who has lived with the flying dragons for more than 200 years, and Amit Abadas, the Shining One. Together with them you will form the Archive Council, which will be supervising the progress of the Arsoft-Chive in the kingdom and liaising with the builders of the temple.
And what about you, Master Barkenseer, will you be with us?
Rangir Soft-Set asked.
Later. First I will return to the absolute white light of Highness. When the time for the archive transfer approaches, I will descend again and work with you in the fields of peace.
Will you tell us more about this temple in the fields of peace, Master Barksoft-Hansir?
Melchard asked tentatively.
How will it be different from the Arsoft-Chive?
The archive will be kept in the temple. But in reality the temple and the Arsoft-Chive will be one, for the archive will contain much more than just knowledge. Spiritual forces and seeds of initiation, this is what the archive is all about.
The end of the kingdom, which has now become unavoidable, will be a compass soft-nigh by massive destruction and chaos.
The knowledge of all temples will be lost. And when a new kingdom is born,
human beings will find themselves in a spiritual desert, with no oracles, no temples, no lineages of initiates and teach-soft-hyphens, no priestly orders. Even the law will have been lost. Our mission is to prepare for the future. In our archive we will preserve the flame of all or nearly all the spiritual orders in the temples of Isra'im and Las-Soft-Hyphensra. We will keep the spirit alive, that men and women of the future may light their torches from our flame. Melchid's eyes were glowing. So is this what will happen at the time of the archive transfer? The traditions which have been kept in our temples since time immemorial will be lifted up into the fields of peace.
Yes, Barkansir answered joyfully, seeing he had rekindled the young man's enthusiasm. And all of us will be there, with you in the fields of peace. Not just the 100 thunderbolt bearers who took part in the clearing Ritz-Soft-Hyphenal, but all of us. Our voices will combine, and it will be the greatest ritual that the Masters of Thunder will ever have performed. So, will Ran Grisset, S. Revin, Gervin and I be performing the ritual both from the kingdom and from the fields of peace? Melchid asked.
No. If everything goes according to plan, only Ran Grisset will be in both places at the same time. His position will allow him to hold the energy in a way that will make it unnecessary for you to be in the kingdom. By then, you will have gathered a large team in Isra'im and Lasira, great field wizards and stone makers, and of course your own apprentices in Thunder. This will be one of your greatest joys, as it has been for the masters of the brown robe who came before you. Train apprentices, watch them grow in Thunder, slowly, and be with them when they make mistakes, help them stand up again each time they trip along the way, and finally see them reach the summits of power that their elders have conquered before them. By the time of the archive transfer, your apprentices will have become accomplished masters of Thunder, and it will be up to them to take care of all operations in the kingdom. There followed a long silence. The three disciples of Ores drank Barkansir's presence, pondering on the new world which was opening before them. Melchid, who always sat with his back very straight, was shining. Barkansir plunged his fiery eyes into him and took his hand. Far above, in the world of the gods, Lord Garna was sitting in front of the Silsoft-very waves of the Molten Sea. Between his hands he held a fantastic musical instrument made of thousands of rays of light. His eyes fixed on the horizon, he smiled. Barkansir smiled. Melchid smiled with him, and a great opening took place. 1.7 Gervin's second meeting with the emissary of Ahriman in the deepest of the night, Gervin felt an ominous presence following him. It did not take him long to recognize Aphelion, the former Master of Thunder who had been Orest's teacher, and who had shocked the Temple of Isra'im by a soft hyphen siding to defect and serve Ahriman, the Prince of Darkness, thereby cutting all his ties with the brown robe. It was difficult to conceive that a man of such knowledge and integrity could have let himself be tempted by the dark side. At first no one had believed the news because Aphelion, or rather Perihelion, as his name had been before he followed Ahriman, had often surprised his friends with his incredible sense of humor, so people thought it must be one of his pranks. But when it became clear that Perihelion would not come back, and that he had become one of the powerful generals of Ahriman, the consternation that struck the temple was beyond words. Perihelion had been a champion of truth, a blazing star in the constellation of the Masters of Thunder. He had conquered the arch-mysterious powers of the deep underworlds, accomplished mind-blowing miracles, and taught and initiated 8 Masters of Thunder to the highest degree, or est among them. And he had been a humble man, who often healed people of lower castes. He had refused the showers of honors that the Prince of Isra'im wanted to bestow on him for having saved his wife, whom the kingdom's best physi-soft-chens had declared paralyzed beyond hope after she fell from the balcony of her royal apartment, but who, 9 weeks after Perihelion's good treatment, was seen trotting around like a phylost rops. How could a man like Perihelion be captured by the dark side? This was a question Orest's disciples asked themselves over and over again with Andy's soft-guised anxiety. For if Perihelion, the teacher of their teacher, could be tempted, then anyone could be tempted, especially younger and less accomplished mass soft-hyphens of Thunder like themselves.
The wise Orest never tried to reassure them with kind, soothing words. Rather, he exhorted them to pray to the Mother of the Light, hold on to the fire, and be ready.